From Nashville and Charlotte, this is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Each week, our panel of shrinks takes a look at pop culture through the fascinating lens of psychology. I'm Dave Verhagen here in Nashville. I'm a psychologist, author, Comic-Con panelist, and your brand new winner of Dancing with the Stars. And today, our Charlotte panel's missing not quite Dr. Wright, Emma Kate Wright, but it now includes, as always, psychologist, we think, author, Aspicon founder, and Comic-Con and Heroes Con panelist, Dr. Frank Gaskell. Hello, Frank.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Dave.
So Frank is usually feeling pretty passionately about something, so he's usually either really happy or really upset about something. So Frank, what is it today?
I am going to get a new little title that you announced me with.
What's that?
TEDx speaker.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So is that a definite? Is that a done deal?
Well, it's definitely maybe happening.
Yeah. 17 people are, or 15 people are brought through, but on the last minute, three people are kicked out. So a little bit of pressure, but, you know, I think I got this.
So are you sure you really want us to introduce you as a TEDx speaker if it's not a done deal yet?
No. I'm about to get it.
Oh,
I'll get the title in October.
The about to get Frank Gaskell.
You're pre-TEDx.
So there it is.
And what's your topic?
I'll give you one guess.
I'm going to guess you being crazy.
Yes, it's going to be about me being crazy.
White privilege?
Asperger's and dog lotioning.
Thank you. It's your dog lotioning. Yeah, that business is yet to take off, Frank. So maybe this is the big turnaround moment for your dog lotioning business.
As far as you know.
As far as I know. All right. Well, you'll hear more from Frank in a little bit. But our trending topic today is celebrities and suicide. We'll talk more about that in our second segment. That's coming up soon. But first, Jonathan Hederle, who's a licensed professional counselor, an expert on substance abuse treatment, and a certified Asian. He's also written published book chapters on Game of Thrones, Star Wars, and Walking Dead. He served as a panelist for Heroes Con, including again this year. And each week, Jonathan rounds up a story or two of psychology in the news that we call being human.
Well, Dave, this story may not have that much to do with psychology, but it is really trending in our culture, and I thought this would be a great opportunity for us to comment on it. So Harvard recently rescinded admission to 10 students after administrators discovered offensive posts in a private online Facebook messaging group, the Harvard Crimson reported. Topics such as the Holocaust, child abuse, sexual assault, as well as other posts that denigrated minority groups were involved in these memes. So, Frank, as our resident offensive person, what do you make of Harvard's decision? Do you support their decision?
Well, I would say I'm uniquely qualified to answer this question because I was reported by Facebook for nudity.
That's true. At a movie theater. Because your pants were off.
No. Facebook then apologized and said, this is not nudity, and the post is back up.
Because there was not enough show to be considered offensive.
And Dave, just so you know, we have most all of our interns in the Shrink Tank today. And if you might recall, a few years ago, I read an intern's tweets publicly.
That's true.
All the way back to high school.
That's right.
And I screenshotted a few of them. And he got so mad, he got up and walked out, despite the fact I was reading public tweets. Okay? So, yes, I support Harvard's decision. But I think this crap should happen way before somebody gets into college. And yet again, this is a failure of parents and technology and millennials. Thank you.
Oh, boy. Jonathan, it sounds like you might not agree with this decision.
I'm a little ambivalent. I'd like to have some context, to be quite honest. And, I mean, I'll just use some personal examples. Frank and I, we will text memes or other jokes to each other, usually during a staff meeting. That, you know, every meeting tends to run longer than it needs to. And he will send me offensive Asian memes or jokes, and I will do the same. And so there's a part of me that doesn't necessarily endorse that on any type of public forum like the Facebook group. But to me, context does count. One of the things that was commented on in this report is when people felt like their safety was being challenged. So if Frank sends me something that's vulgar, crude, or offensive, I don't feel personally threatened or challenged. So on the one hand, I do think that people have to understand the implications and consequences of, you know, using public platforms to send any type of offensive or insensitive materials. On the other hand, you know, we're talking about a acceptance to Harvard, or you know, where does that line get drawn in terms of, on the one hand, Harvard says we are not responsible for this. On the other hand, they're taking steps where they're actually inserting themselves into this process. I don't know if they can have it both ways.
That's a really good answer, Hederle. I agree with you. That's a great answer.
Okay.
Now you agree with
where's the punchline?
No. For once, I'm agreeing with you.
I mean, what's your thoughts about this, Dave?
Well, I agree with you that in a public forum, you're opening yourself up for something like this. And the tricky thing is here that they're doing this in a way that other people can see it, that aren't necessarily – they're all part of this kind of – I don't know if it's a closed group or what, but it's a group. And so not everybody in that group, I'm sure, is on board with what they're sending, right? So if it's just a text between people – that's private. If it's something that
right.
other people are seeing, then that they're not necessarily on board with the idea, then I think they've got more grounds for it. What really hits me, though, is you're talking about Harvard students or potential Harvard students, people that have been admitted. These are like top one, less than 1% in terms of just college acceptance, and they're still making dodo head decisions. They're still being banana
right.
heads about it. So I'm really more struck by that. It's like we're at a place culturally where even the sharpest students don't see that there should be a boundary between what's more of a personal correspondence and what's more public. That's a really interesting cultural shift for me.
I have one other thought on that is I think we'll be talking about it at some point, but how comedians are not wanting to go to college campuses because they're all politically correct, safe zones, or whatever that stuff is, right? So by shoving that stuff down and creating a culture where you can't joke anymore, does that then shove the people who want to joke even further underground and make their humor even more extreme because there's not an outlet for it?
Right.
Well, and this kind of is a callback to a previous Being Human segment we did where the study revealed that liberals are just as intolerant as conservatives and just as biased in their beliefs. And so, again, it becomes this question of when we're trying to create a culture of acceptance and sensitivity, are we going so overboard that we become just as guilty of others of ignorance, insensitivity, and bias?
Right. And I think, you know, what we're finding is that social media is shaping our culture in such radical ways. It's shaped the political landscape. It's shaped entertainment. It's shaping everything that we're kind of in this place where there's going to be overreactions on both sides. There's going to be people that don't manage it well and make really stupid decisions, and there are going to be people that overreact to it. And so I don't think we've still, even though we've been around social media for a decade now, I still don't think we've found our bearings on it and kind of where the lines are, even like as an institution. So you're, you know, it's a Facebook page. It's not a Harvard page. It's Facebook's page. And yet they're saying because this is something that is a collection of Facebook, I mean, of a Harvard students or potential students coming in, that we have the right to rescind your acceptance. That's we're in kind of uncharted territory with that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, it will be our trending topic. It's celebrities and suicide. And this is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Good psychology can change your life. At PsychBytes, we feature articles and videos with practical psychology that you can use every day. PsychBytes is a new psychology website with free articles and videos from dozens of the best psychology experts. Check it out on psychbytes.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville, along with Frank Gaskell and Jonathan Hederle in Charlotte. And our trending topic today is celebrities and suicide. It's a topic we've talked about before, but it's made fresh by the suicide of Chris Cornell in a really strange set of circumstances. Also, there have been some other suicides this calendar year, Aaron Hernandez. There was a MTV reality star named Clay Adler, who's not super well known, but he's a young guy, a very tragic kind of set of circumstances. So we want to get into that. And before we talk about the broader topic, I want to ask Jonathan, were you a fan of Chris Cornell? You're our music guy. Were you a fan of his music?
I was. I really hadn't followed a lot of his work outside of the 90s with Soundgarden. I grew up in the Seattle area. And the reality is that Soundgarden actually had, in that region, a stronger level of respect than Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam was oftentimes sort of seen as the posers that came on in, and even as talented as they were more of a classic rock sound than the hard rock grunge merge. But Soundgarden and Chris Cornell was sort of viewed in that kind of center with Nirvana and probably Alice in Chains as kind of purists of that movement. And from a vocalist standpoint, he had one of the purest voices of that kind of generation and that genre of time. Like, he had such phenomenal range, whereas Eddie Vedder and Chris Cobain, their vocals was really about the texture and personality that it conveyed.
Yeah, it is definitely a loss for sure. You know how sometimes you have a celebrity suicide that really hits you hard, like Robin Williams, or for me, it was River Phoenix back in the day. Was this one that hit you especially hard? Did you have some kind of emotional attachment to him and his music?
It hit me hard, but for different reasons. One was it just immediately made me think back to Kurt Cobain and just the real tragedy that his suicide was. But the other thing that struck me was, unlike, let's say, Robin Williams here recently, about a year ago, in a lot of ways, Chris Cornell did not demonstrate a lot of warning signs leading up to this, that his life was actually in a real scary or bad place. By all accounts, he had struggled with addiction. He seemed to have kind of really kicked that and seemed to be in a place of sobriety and overall well-being. He wasn't really showing signs of depression or even kind of a career plunge. He and Soundgarden were really working on new material. Everything about what was going on in his life indicated that he was in a real hopeful and positive place. So the fact that all of a sudden, right after a show, he commits suicide. And then the method, which just the uniqueness of him hanging himself as his means of death, really kind of was very unsettling.
Well, and let me ask you about that, because the circumstances are so weird. He plays a show. He doesn't give any signs of it during the day, throughout the show, afterwards. And then he goes back and hangs himself in a city that's not even his own city. I mean, it's just a random city for him. His wife was very shocked. I don't think she still is convinced that this is suicide.
Yeah.
I think she thinks he had a weird reaction to medicine. There's some conversation about him taking Ativan, which is an anxiety medicine. But I'm sure that Ativan can cause a weird reaction in some people. But it certainly, I've never heard of anything like that where it would cause you to kill yourself. So the circumstances are really strange. I mean, they're really weird. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, when the toxicology report came back and they declared that medication did not play a role in his death, that kind of created more questions than answers. The only thing that I thought of, and it's not particularly clear in his case, but I've experienced this working with other clients and other folks with backgrounds in suicide and depression, is I've actually come across folks that have had some real bouts of depression and low, hopeless periods of life. And actually, when things get better, the scary thing is that sometimes men will have actually the willpower and the energy and agency to actually follow through and kill themselves, which really throws everybody off, because they'll say they're really in a great place, but oftentimes that's because they're coming out of a period of real despondency and hopelessness, and now that life is better, they actually have the energy and the wherewithal to take their own life. And I don't know if that's what was going on with Chris Cornell, but that was one of the things that I thought of, is not every suicide is the result of coming or being in a really dark and morbid place. Sometimes they have those intrusive reoccurring thoughts, and it just, it really is a perfect intersection of opportunity and follow through than it is that their life is in shambles.
Well, it's kind of like if you're a 10 on a 10 scale for depression, like you're so depressed, you can't think straight, you don't have any energy, and then you start feeling a little bit better, but now you're like an 8, you know, you're kind of lifting up. Now you've got more energy, you can collect your thoughts a little bit. You're actually, for some people, at a higher risk of killing yourself during that time than you are when you were like just flat on your back. So there is some possibility that something like that was going on. Frank?
Yeah, when I was getting ready for this, I was looking through all the lists of people who've done this, and you see photos scroll by, and it's just man, 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 then woman. So I don't know the stats on it, but I think what Hederle's saying makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, and women report more suicidal thoughts, even more suicide attempts, but men are much more lethal when they attempt suicide. In other words, they complete suicide much more often. So yeah. Women report the thoughts more, they even report attempts more, but men complete it a lot more often.
And they use more lethal and extreme methods.
Right. Shooting themselves.
50%. Yeah, 50% usually involve a gun or a weapon. The other thing I was thinking about Chris Cornell, because when they listed all the things that was going on in his life, and you kind of have to take this from the perspective of someone that may not be really thinking clearly about things, but if somebody that struggled with depression, and Chris Cornell was very open about that, life was in a good place, Soundgarden was recording and touring, does somebody get to a point where they say, how I'm feeling right now, this is the best it's ever going to be, ever again? Because they know, and they have such a strong history of depression and low points in their life, that this is the best that it's going to ever be, and they don't ever want to go back to that real low or hopeless place. And so they make a decision that to kind of go out at a high point. And as morbid and distorted of thinking that sounds to folks that can't relate to depression or suicidality, we know that that's how some folks kind of think about these
yeah.
things.
Mm-hmm. Frank, we have talked about suicide even recently with 13 Reasons Why, and we've talked about this topic before. But one of the interesting things that comes up over and over again is that really creative people, artists, musicians, actors, seem to have higher rates of mood disorders, of bipolar, of depression, and consequently of risks for suicide. First, what do you make of that?
Well, I listened to a lot of Howard Stern's interviews with a lot of musicians and actors. And they all have sort of this common thread of they went through a dark spot, they came through it, but they contemplated suicide. And the way they talk about either getting lost in their work and getting creative and then becoming successful and then losing that limelight, I think there's a piece of that. I think there's something about the creative brain. You've got, the author? Shoot. Her name escapes me. When you go through the old people who killed themselves documented in 1800s, it's poets, it's all these authors, it's Mozart didn't kill himself, but the loss of the star power, I guess. There was that boy from DSW. He was also the kid from not Full House. Can't remember the name of these stupid shows, but they're turning 19 and then they kill themselves because they run into money problems. They're living in this crappy little hotel and this amazing life that they had is now gone. And what these people in the interview, they say, when you're on and everybody's taking care of you. But when they let you go immediately and everything's gone. And that's, I don't see how people can stand a shock to that system. It's just brutal.
Right. So it might be a combination of having a differently wired brain to start with and then being mm-hmm. in a context where you're coddled and nurtured and then all of a sudden the right. bottom falls out. And so you put those two things together and that could be brutal. Jonathan, mm-hmm. what's your thought about the impact of something like this in particular? Let's stick with Chris Cornell in particular, someone that is a musician, but also a middle-aged man. So not a kid.
That's weird.
A middle-aged man. And there, we know that the rates of suicide among middle-aged men are actually up, probably in recent years. And what do you think the impact of this is culturally?
Well, I mean, research is telling us all the age demographics up to age 75 and below, suicide has been trending upward for the last 10 to 15 years. And a lot of people don't recognize that. And there can be a number of things that are contributing to that: stress, an anxious world, puberty starting earlier. We know that the kind of economic crisis that hit in the early 2000s really put a lot of older folks with some extreme hardship and life challenges, and a lot of people haven't recovered from that. When I was growing up, you know, mental health, mental illness, suicide, it was really kind of limited to, well, those people are just kind of nutty or batty, or they must have had horrible, traumatic childhoods, things of that nature. And we're just kind of learning more and more with these rates going up in every demographic. That's not the case anymore. People that you know, people that seem to have their life together, for whatever reason, they're seeing taking their own life as an acceptable option of dealing with life adversity and hardship. And so I think Chris Cornell, unlike Robin Williams, who Robin Williams had a very public platform where people understood his deep, severe depression and how he would just go into these huge bouts that sometimes would last months, if not years. And you could see his career trajectory ebb and flow with his mental health and the instability of that. Chris Cornell, in the last 10 or 15 years, it seemed like his life was together. And so that really, again, not only just a middle-aged man, but men in general and how they are prone to not be open to help, not talk about their problems. And most of us, the three of us, we see a lot of young guys that by the time they come into my office, the problem is escalated. They've dug themselves into a deeper ditch. And a lot of times there's not a quick turnaround because the problem's been around for a while. They just haven't addressed it.
Yeah. Well, this goes without saying, but if you're listening and you are struggling with depression or having suicidal thoughts, it really does make a difference if you reach out. Help is available, and it really does make a difference. We've had, all of us have had individuals, clients who have come in a really bad place, very hopeless, considering ending it, and have ended up having really rich lives, and they've thrived. So we really encourage people to reach out. No matter where you're listening from, there's going to be some help available. So we're going to take a break. We're going to lighten things up a little bit with our summer quiz when we come back. And this is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Hero House Publishing is pleased to announce Heroic Inspirations by Michael Kreitzer. Over the ages, superheroes in various forms have been speaking to humanity in togas, robes, and now tights and capes. They speak to us about the human condition. They help us work through our fears and failures. Heroic Inspirations draws out rich lessons superheroes provide for our daily lives. How does Superman teach us to deal with difficult people? What do the X-Men tell us about balancing individual and communal identities? Superheroes speak to these and many other life questions. Michael Kreitzer has been researching and teaching on superheroes for over 10 years, and now his book, Heroic Inspirations, is available to you at herohousepublishing.com or amazon.com. Order your copy today.
Back again with Dave Verhagen, Frank Gaskell, and Jonathan Hederle, and we wrap this all up with our summer quiz, and I've got five questions for you guys. This is just to kind of highlight some of the things that are going on this summer and give us a chance to talk about
five.
A little. Yeah, we've got something about music.
Five questions.
Music, movies, sports, and television. So we've got five questions for you guys, and the first one is about something that's going on this week. And actually, it's about 60 miles from where I'm sitting. It's Bonnaroo.
Ooh. Oh, Bonnaroo.
Bonnaroo.
Calm down. All right, so Bonnaroo is from June 7th through the 11th. And here's the question. How many acres is Bonnaroo on? The site where Bonnaroo is held is how many acres? This is Price is Right rules, closest without going over.
How many acres is Bonnaroo?
How many acres?
On. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, do we get multiple choice or this is
no,
Price is Right rules.
Price is Right rules.
Okay. All right. Frank, you go first on this one.
I am going to go 150 acres.
150.
I nailed it.
I will go 151.
Okay. Do you want to open this up to the interns or no?
Yeah.
Okay. Ask them how many acres they think Bonnaroo's on.
Interns, how many acres is Bonnaroo? Quick. 70. We have a 70?
Tell them they don't have to whisper.
125, you don't need to whisper. And
700.
700 acres.
About
okay.
Phineas and Ferb in Nashville.
All right. Hunter, 250. Austin,
152.
This man knows how to play some prices right.
That's Asian on Asian hostility, man. I thought we had to stick together.
So let me ask you this. The person that said 700, was that person on their mobile device?
Who guessed 700?
No, she was not on her mobile device.
Who is it that said that?
That's Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
Wait,
is...
you said 700? Elizabeth, I love Lamp. Elizabeth Lampy.
Elizabeth Lampy says 700. She is exactly right. It was 700.
Wow. Exactly right.
Yep.
700.
375 Man. Football fields worth of music festival. 700 well, acres.
She goes to Bucknell, so... That makes sense.
That's crazy. Yeah. All right.
Here we go.
Learn something new every
so,
day.
So we didn't have any cheating there. Is that true?
No, Elizabeth does not cheat.
Okay. Elizabeth is a non-cheater. All right. Question number two. Wonder Woman set box office records for several things, including the highest box office gross for a movie directed by a woman. How much did it make in its opening weekend in millions? We'll start with...
100.
With Frank.
$100 million.
Jonathan.
$100,700,000.
Okay. Round robin, quick with the interns.
Okay, how much did Wonder Woman make in the opening weekend?
1.2.
1.2 million.
We have a 1.2 million guess.
1 billion.
1 billion.
2.3
million. Okay.
Okay, we're done here.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, Hunter says 1.7. Austin says... 250 million? 250 million? Okay, there we go.
When you ask him to repeat it in an exasperated tone, Dave, I think you're giving away hints. 250
Well, I didn't know if he meant 250,000 or 250 million. Okay.
Say my name, Dave. Say my name.
I'm going to say Frank's name. It's 103 million.
Oh, 103.
Winning.
Okay. Number three, the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Nashville Predators are in the Stanley Cup Finals. After each Stanley Cup championship, what in particular is etched onto a tier of the trophy? I need a very specific answer. What is etched onto a tier of the trophy? Jonathan.
What is etched?
Like,
what is etched on the Stanley Cup
engraved.
After they win?
What's engraved?
Engraved.
What is engraved?
This team of white people won hockey. Hashtag winning it.
Yeah, I doubt that.
No. No. Pick up your teeth as you leave.
Jeez.
I don't know. Do I look like a hockey fan?
Okay. All of the players' names.
All the players' names.
Yes.
Hunter says the coach's name. The team name. Okay. Whoever said all... the team players' names won.
Say my name.
Frank, you won.
I didn't win that
no.
one? Oh, man.
Yeah. By the way, here's another little quickie question. How many babies have been baptized in the actual Stanley Cup?
How many babies have been baptized
yeah.
in the actual
I will tell you while you're thinking that the Stanley Cup has been at the bottom of three swimming pools, almost all from lots of heavy drinking. But there also have been a number of babies baptized. How many? What's your guess? Real quick. Just you and Frank.
200.
200 babies. No, two. Oh.
two babies.
I was closer with my going over.
200 babies.
Okay, two babies.
What it's like, they just set it up in a church and just have a little assembly line. Okay.
Hey, that's what they do in Korea, like mass weddings, mass baptisms. Yeah.
All right, two more questions. Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk is already being talked about for Oscar consideration. It depicts the Dunkirk evacuation of Allied soldiers from the beaches of Dunkirk, France, in 1940. How many boats were involved in that rescue? Frank.
That would be 211.
211. Jonathan.
212.
Hunter. 180. Austin. 150. Interns in Charlotte.
How many boats, rescued in Dunkirk, the people on the beach?
152. 101. 90.
190.
All right. The answer is 933.
Wow, 933.
It was 400,000 soldiers, right?
It was close to 400. They ultimately rescued 338,000 soldiers in 8 days.
That's a miracle.
That is a miracle. All right, last question. Easy question. Game of Thrones Season 7 returns on July 16th, and it is the shortest season they've ever had, but it's also supposed to be the most action-packed season they've ever had. How many episodes will there be in Season 7? Jonathan?
I'll say 6.
Okay. Frank?
5.
Hunter? 5.
8
for Austin. Okay.
How many episodes of the new season of Game of Thrones will there be? Nadine says 5. 10?
7.
7. Okay.
Whoever had 7 is our winner. It's
7
episodes.
Wins.
7 for 7.
Wow.
All right. Well, you know what? Just like we always say, there are no losers here. We're all winners. Well, there are no losers.
Except for
Frank.
Except
right.
for Frank.
I'm the
That's
loser.
What we say. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. We hope you'll check out shrinktank.com for articles, videos, and polls about movies, TV, music, and all kinds of things. Make sure you check out shrinktank.com. Also, follow us on Twitter @shrink_tank or like us on Facebook by searching for the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our producer and theme music composer is Sean Beck. In the Queen City, it's Jonathan Hederle and Frank Gaskell. And from Music City, I'm Dave Verhagen. Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends about us. And make it a great week.